Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
That's right, weather fans. It actually snowed in Minnesota this week. But since September 1st, it's been Minnesota's warmest slide on record through fall and into the season, formerly known as winter. Green grass in December, open water lakes, closed outdoor skating rinks, thunder sleet in the metro. That's what Nick Benson heard in Burnsville yesterday. It's no wonder we're all a little seasonally confused this year, but what's the science behind our reluctant Seattle winter so far? And will the strongest El Nino in a generation keep our Minnesota winter on life support? Good morning, everybody. I'm NPR News Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner, and you're in the Weather Lab at NPR News.
Nearly the entire country is asking the same question. Where's winter? Who took it?
Temperatures near the 70s, some temperatures not seen since the 1920s or thereabouts.
This weather is crazy, bringing us such unusual sights, including people coming up to pick up the trees behind me in flip-flops and t-shirts.
And I just can't wait for the ice, but there isn't any ice yet on the lake.
No, there's not. You can call it weather weirding. The colder breezes, yeah, they're finally here, but not before another week off the charts with warmth for Minnesota. December's surreal weather numbers so far. How about this? Wednesday's high of 41 degrees in the Twin Cities makes 10 of 16 days so far this month with highs in the 40s. So far, December running a jaw-dropping 14 degrees warmer than average in the Twin Cities and most of Minnesota. The coldest daytime high in the metro before today, just 34 degrees on December 1st. That's right. Not once until today has the Twin Cities recorded a daytime high below freezing so far this December. And as you heard, many lakes in Minnesota are still open, and they're fast approaching the latest ice-in dates on record. The biggest factor keeping lakes open into mid-December this year, an incredible run of overnight warm minimum temperatures. Overnight lows have been running an astounding 20 to 25 degrees warmer than average this past week across Minnesota. So today, a closer look at our reluctant winter so far, and I may have overstuffed this hour a bit. We'll take the pulse of Twin Cities pond hockey tournament organizers to ask what open water on December 17th might mean for their events next month. And later in ClimateCast, University of St. Thomas's John Abraham is here to break down what the Paris Climate Agreement really means. Of course, it wouldn't be a weather chat in Minnesota without you, so fire up the Bluetooth while the boss is turned away. Give me a call now, 651-227-6000, toll-free at 800-242-2828, and online at nprnews.org/live. Up first today, how are plants, animals, and people dealing with this record early winter warmth? John Latimer is a Minnesota naturalist and host of the Phenology Show on KAXE Community Radio in Grand Rapids. John, I should start by saying congratulations on about 6 inches of new snow up there.
Yeah, it's white. We're going to have a white Christmas if it doesn't warm up too much in the next couple of days. It's heavy, though. It was yesterday I was out shoveling. Temperature was around 32, 31, on my deck, as I pushed the shovel forward, my feet slid backwards.
Yeah, that's a winter wonderland for sure. And I think you're going to hang on to that snow until Christmas up in the Grand Rapids area and really all of northern Minnesota. I saw a foot up at Golden Eagle Lodge along the Gunflint Trail, 13 inches in Isabella. Even southwest Minnesota picked up 7 inches or so of snow around Appleton and Madison. So basically draw a line from Marshall, Pipestone, up through St. Cloud to Duluth, where they set a daily snowfall record of 8 inches yesterday. And I think those areas, everything north and west of that line, pretty much a lock for a white Christmas. However, the lakes are still open in mid-December. That's kind of like a climate barometer for Minnesota. The ice-in and ice-out dates really closely reflect seasonal weather patterns. How late is the ice up north this year? And is there still any open water in the Grand Rapids area?
Oh, many, many lakes are still open. The smaller lakes, I live on a lake of about 70 acres, about 25 feet deep, and it froze on the 22nd this year, which is a few days later than average. I think 18th is when I typically have my lake ice in. But lakes like Pokegama and Wabana, Deer, I'm sure there are other. Sugar Lake is probably still open. Mm-hmm. These lakes typically are frozen by now. I'm trying to think, probably 2000 or 2009, I think, was when we set our lake ice in date records of around the 20th of December. My lake froze on the 4th of December that year, which was the latest that I'd ever recorded.
So we are pushing the record latest dates up in the Grand Rapids area this year. Is that pretty accurate to say?
That is. And this bit of cold that you're talking about now may freeze some of them. I had one lake on my travels that had ice on it a week ago, and then the warm weather and the winds broke the ice up, and the lake was open on Tuesday when I was up there, and I expect that that one may freeze again.
Well, which is interesting, because that's happened a lot to some of the ponds, the smaller ponds in the metro as well, and that's pretty unusual for winter to get that first freeze over and then have it break up again. It takes some pretty warm temperatures to do that. You're seeing that up there. I also noticed, John, central Minnesota lakes like Gull nearing the record latest freeze date of December 22nd, North Long, December 24th, Pelican, Whitefish, all getting close to that record latest ice in. So it's not just a Twin Cities phenomenon. It extends all the way up to the Iron Range.
Yeah, yeah, this is unusual.
Let's talk about ice cover, okay? We've noticed over the seasons that it is shrinking on both the fall and the springtime. Overall, every year, of course, is different. But what kind of effect does ice cover or less ice cover have on fish and aquatic life in our lakes? Why is it important?
Well, it seems that they need that time. They at least I'm most familiar with northerns, having spent a long part of my life in the company of an expert on northerns, and it seems that they need this time of year to kind of rest and sort of settle down. They don't feed as voraciously after the ice comes on the lake. It gets a little darker in there, and they just are a little bit more sedentary.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of feeding voraciously, Isaac in Minneapolis is with us and wants to know a little bit about ice fishing trip he's got planned. Isaac, good morning. How you doing? What's your question for John this morning?
Well, I'm doing pretty good, although it might depend on John's answer. We got our annual ice fishing trip to Grand Rapids area scheduled for January 8th and 9th, and we're just debating whether to reschedule. We're not big. We don't drive out on the lake typically, but we want at least, you know, 6 inches of ice on the bigger lakes by then to feel comfortable.
Sure. John, what do you think? 6 inches by the first week of January?
Oh, I would be absolutely, I'm confident in saying that we'll have that. I have, in 33 years of keeping records, I've never had a year where we haven't had more than that ice by January. If it happens this year, I will be astonished.
Yeah, I'm with you mostly. I'm confident we're going to see those lakes ice over maybe as early as Friday or Saturday morning. The key is getting the wind to calm down, the air to go calm. And Saturday morning with temperatures up around zero, Grand Rapids are slightly above, I think a lot of those lakes are gonna ice over. The thing is, there's still a lot of stored heat in some of those lakes from our mild fall. But Isaac, I hope that helps you out, and good luck heading up to Grand Rapids in the early part of January. John, El Nino, it's a big factor this year, each year different, obviously. What are you seeing with longer-term trends of ice cover in your area and in Minnesota in general?
Well, it's interesting that you ask. The ice in days, well, the ice-free days, In my records for the lakes that I keep track of, they're gradually increasing, but the trend line is not statistically significant. Part of the problem is that here in the Grand Rapids area, we haven't had a lot of fluctuations in our temperature. So if you look at the long-term average for the Grand Rapids area, we're pretty flat. We're not exactly going warmer or colder. We're mm-hmm. kind of neutral and that's on a yearly basis. But if you look at the last few years, you get this really accelerated sort of jagged, you know, if you think of the chart as kind of a sawtooth chart,
sure.
All at once you've got some really large teeth at the end here. Years ago, I used to say that 1987 was my earliest and 1996 was my latest. They sort of bookended all of my observations. And now 2012 and 2013 are my bookends. Those are the earliest and the latest.
Interesting. Yeah, we're seeing more variability. Of course, in Minnesota overall, we're seeing that strongest warming signal from the climate in winter and at night in winter. In fact, Minnesota, according to Climate Central data, the fastest warming state in the nation in winter. Stephanie Curtis is here, and she's been cruising the internets for some perspective this morning. Stephanie, what do you got?
Yeah, Kyle submitted a question at nprnews.org/live. He asks, how much does a dry and or warm winter affect next season's crop growth?
Oh, that's an interesting one. John, you want to pivot to that and give us a shot?
Yeah, let me take a shot at that. What I have seen over the years is that if you have an early spring, if you have a nice warm, like if we don't have much of a winter and say in March we start seeing snow cover decline, all of a sudden you'll see certain species of plants that will really start to leaf out early, and it can affect the plant over the year's time, in that oftentimes you'll get an early leaf out. And in the fall, you'll have that same tree dropping its leaves earlier.
Mm.
So the time span seems to be the same. Interestingly, the red maple tree is sort of non-responsive to that kind of a temperature thing. It seems that the red maple needs a certain amount of cooling in the wintertime. And if it doesn't get that, it doesn't respond to an early spring the way, say, a quaking aspen might. So, and as far as crops, I don't live in cropland area. There are a few farmers up here who grow some soybeans and some
sure.
corn, but I don't see that sort of thing. I'm mostly in looking at natural or native plants. And so an early or a light winter, easy winter, dry spring, you'll have early leaf out, but you'll probably also have a following fall of early leaf drop.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing we look at, too, after these El Nino winters is a La Nina coming back, and that can sometimes produce drought in summer, so that's something we'll be keeping an eye on next year for the crop season. John, a listener from Brown County in southwest Minnesota, John Kinsley, sent me a photo of a lilac bud breaking yesterday in
wow.
December. We've had 50s in southwest Minnesota this month. Can these extreme out-of-season warm spells that we get trick plants in the landscape?
I have a lot of records that show that very thing. I had cowslips, marsh marigolds blooming on the 15th of November, New England asters on the 19th. Somebody sent me a picture of a strawberry in the Grand Rapids area in bloom on the 10th of November. Aspen buds bursting. The aspens are a member of the willow family, so think of pussy willows.
Mm-hmm.
And the trembling aspen puts out a bud very similar to that, a flower. And they were breaking bud in the middle of November, which is totally unusual.
Wow.
And same thing is true of, I have pussy willows here at my house that are open and little white pussy willows, but
incredible.
I don't expect them to develop into the flower, but
sure.
they will stay like that pretty much all winter.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with John Latimer. He's a naturalist in Grand Rapids. We're getting a handle on how this record warm start to winter is affecting fish, birds, and animals around us. Your calls always welcome. What are you seeing in the environment as we head through one of the warmest starts to winter on record? 651-227-6000. Or toll-free at 800-242-2828, online at nprnews.org/live. What about animals in the landscape? How do they react to extreme warmth like this? Are there critters out there doing unusual things for December?
Well, let's focus on birds first. And let me say that normally this time of year, northern Minnesota would be populated with large flocks of pine siskins and red poles and pine grosbeaks. And there are some around. People are seeing a few, but it's not like we've had in the past. And I suspect the fact that there isn't much snow cover, these birds all forage on wild seeds for the most part. And I suspect that they are finding ample food supplies further north and therefore aren't driven this far south yet. So in the bird world, that's sort of happening. On the animal side, chipmunks, which are sort of a torporous kind of a critter, they store food. They don't really hibernate in the sense that a woodchuck hibernates, but they do kind of go underground and stay underground. We've had woodchucks out here, chipmunks out here in early December. I think the latest was around the 4th or 5th of this month. So chipmunks are still gathering food.
Wow.
It's pretty strange.
And when you're a phenologist, how observant are people in Minnesota, do you think, about what's happening in the landscape? Are they pretty in tune?
It's interesting you should ask that. I began this whole thing about 33 years ago talking about animals and plants and in the world and encouraging people to start looking. And for the longest time, immediately I got a response. People were definitely interested. But over the years, I've cultivated quite a group of people up here who are very good phenologists. We have a Facebook site called KAXE, KBXE Season Watch, and you might want to check it out because the people are recording their observations daily almost, and so it's become quite popular. But in the broader sense, Paul, I would have to say that too many people are not tuned into what's happening around them in the world. They're just kind of oblivious of it.
Well, Stephanie Curtis has somebody who may be tuned in. Stephanie, what do you got?
Bill has an alarming question for us. He says, I would imagine the ticks are having an easy time this winter, so it should fall. It should make the tick population increase next summer. Is that true?
What do you think, John? Is it going to be a tick fest next year?
I don't know enough about the actual natural history of the ticks to know if they're going to increase or decrease in numbers, but I'll tell you this. I had a deer tick on my shoulder blade a week ago. So,
wow.
There and I have the wood tick, the common dog tick. They're sort of May, June, and then they're gone because they dry out and they can't tolerate the heat of summer. And you might see one in August or September, but that's sort of their life cycle. But now I don't think I have a month of the year where I haven't got a report of somebody finding a deer tick on their dog or on themselves. Mm-hmm. It seems like if we get a warm-up in January where the temperature climbs into the 40s, somebody will report, my dog has a deer tick or I got a deer tick. So the deer ticks are really the little blackleg ticks. They are really... they're becoming a real bane to northern Minnesota.
Yes, they are. Listen, we've got just about 30 seconds left, but Jerry in Spring Valley wants to know, how could the warm winter affect the maple syrup harvest next spring? Always important in Minnesota. What do you think?
Ooh, that's a tough one. You know, I have talked with many, many people about maple syrup, and it is one of those mysteries that just, I don't know. I wouldn't want to make a guess. Other years where we've had El Ninos, we've done pretty well with maple syrup in the following spring, but that can be a lot of different factors.
Well, John Latimer, host of the Phenology Show on KAXE Community Radio in Grand Rapids, thank you so much for sharing your insight with our audience today.
Thank you, Paul. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Hey, I want to drive the Zamboni.
Yes, winter in Minnesota means, among other things, hockey. They call us the state of hockey for good reason, right? We're less than a month away today from the start of the biggest pond hockey tournament in Minnesota on Lake Nokomis. And the week after that, another big outdoor hockey event kicks off in Excelsior on Lake Minnetonka. This week, open water on both lakes as tournament organizers and players like me, yes, I play in pond hockey tournaments, wondering if the events will go on as scheduled or if we'll be playing boot hockey in the parking lot in mid-January. What about the long-range forecast, you ask? Well, it is going to get cooler, but all indicators still show a mild bias for the second half of December, and the uber long-range outlook still favors above-average temperatures overall in January. With me to talk about all things pond hockey today, I'm happy to have Jim Dahlin from the U.S. Pond Hockey Championship on Lake Nokomis and Justin Pagel from the North American Pond Hockey Championship on Lake Minnetonka. Good morning, you guys.
Hey, Paul.
Hey. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Jim, the Nokomis event is on the schedule. First, let's start with you. A question I know is on our listeners' mind. Just how much ice thickness does it take to hold a pond hockey tournament?
Well, I mean, we would ideally look to have about, you know, a foot of ice, nice solid ice that's out there. And that means that we're able to have everything that we're used to having out there, like spectators, our ice resurfacer. We're able to use some of our bigger equipment to be able to clear out the spaces. But we're, you know, we can be skating out there with rinks as little between 6 to 8 inches of really good solid ice. So we're going to be anxiously looking at what the ice conditions look like next week and then towards the end of the month, and then what the forecast looks like beyond that.
Justin, Tonka, of course, a much bigger lake than Nokomis. Is 6 to 8 inches enough for your event?
It is, but not for our heavy machinery that takes, you know, away from using all our volunteers' time. But like he said, 6 to 8 inches we could get it done with. But we're hoping, you know, get 18-plus inches to take away, you know, some of the hard work that all our volunteers will come and help with.
Sure. Jim, your event's up first. We're less than a month till puck drop. When do you have to make the call if the event is a go or a no-go, and what about a plan B if there's not enough ice on Nokomis?
Well, I'm sure that Justin would agree. You know, we've got plans B, C, D, E, and F, and it all kind of depends on what things are looking like. You know, next week will be an important one for us because the forecasts that start to go into the preparation phases will be a little bit more solid there. So we're going to be looking next week we really want to make sure that our participants who do travel in from 40 different states have enough time to understand exactly what things are looking like. So we're going to spend Christmas hopefully thinking about Santa and some gifts that day, but obviously mm-hmm. the weather's going to be on our mind.
And the latest I'm looking at, it looks like maybe Saturday morning we'll get that calm air and temperatures around 10 above. I suppose it's conceivable Nokomis could ice over. At least we'll keep our fingers crossed for that. Justin, what about you guys in Excelsior? When will you have to make the call, and what's plan B?
Well, this is Minnesota, and, you know, growing up here, I've never been able not to skate on the lake in January.
Sure.
In Excelsior Bay, we don't get the ice shifting like the other parts of the lake where there can be some major cracks and so forth. So we're hoping that, we at least get that 6 to 8 inches to at least be able to get people out there. We do have backup plans, but we're not going to, you know, really install those until after, you know, the first of the year comes around.
Tell us a little about the logistics of putting on a pond hockey tournament on a frozen lake in the middle of winter in Minnesota. Start with you, Jim. It must be a pretty substantial task.
Well, we've got some pretty incredible partners that help us with our massive tent, which is nearing the size of, it looks like a football field out there. So getting that put together, and our ice ops crew from the Recess Factory who come in from Colorado to help install the 25 rinks that we place out there. And then an army of volunteers. That's really what it comes down to is, you know, getting our tent, our rinks put together, and then everyone that just helps the participants that come down for the free event to be able to understand where they're going, where their teams are playing, and to have fun, ideally with a little bit of frost growing on your beard as you're out there.
And Jim, you mentioned you get players from all over the country. What are some of the odd places that we get hockey players coming into Minnesota in the middle of a Minnesota winter?
Well, I'll tell you, I've been paying more attention to the weather than the rosters right now. But we've had, you know, people travel in from South America, which is interesting.
Wow.
In the 11 years that we've been going on. So some of the warmer climates are interesting, but a lot of it is from the traditional, you know, hockey markets, Canada, and a big draw from locally here in Minnesota.
Justin, I know the Excelsior event's a little more of a community-focused event. Tell us a little bit about the focus of the pond hockey tournament out there in Excelsior.
Yeah, the history is obviously when myself and Steve Youngstead, Jay Lindsay, took it over as a charity event, the passing of Dave Bigham. And really the community has come together for Dave and for everybody around and his family. And we've kind of made it a tradition now where putting up the rinks and taking them down has become a really fun event for everybody involved, and get together, you know, work hard for a couple hours, and then, you know, go inside and have, you know, a beer or a sandwich. Or Maynard's has been very gracious to our tournament and hosting it right out in front there. So it's become, you know, a great tradition, and everybody likes to be together, and it's really more fun, you know, for that camaraderie than anything else.
And Jim, talk a little bit about the camaraderie. I've played in the Excelsior event the last 3 years, and I got to tell you, it's one of the funnest weekends of the year. What's the vibe like out at the U.S. Pond Hockey Championships on Nokomis every year?
Yeah, I think that that's something that transcends pond hockey overall. I mean, it's really, as we've said, you know, hockey the way nature intended, and it's the way that you know, myself, the last caller, being up in Grand Rapids, that's where I was born and raised. So I, on Lake Pekegama, grew up playing pond hockey right there on the lake. So really the event is, if it's from people really getting together and playing hockey the way you did growing up. And at the end of the day, we have a picture with the golden shovel to the champion, but scores are not as important as the memories you take away from Nokomis. And that's what people talk about, is what was that like? You know, what was that play? Did you see that snipe from half ice? That's what people remember far more than the score. And that's what we're excited about, to just kind of have that weekend where guys and girls can get back together and play hockey the way they did growing up.
And it's a beautiful thing if you're a hockey fan in Minnesota. Well, Jim and Justin, I'll kick the Doppler a few more times to see if we can get an Arctic outbreak on the weather maps. But in the meantime, thanks so much for telling our listeners about this fascinating and very weather-dependent slice of winter in Minnesota.
Thanks, guys.
I know one guy who comes through no matter what the weather, whether it's winter, summer, or any season. He's Phil Picardi, and he's here with the news. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Paul. Thank you very much. The former hedge fund manager who has been widely criticized for buying a drug company and then hiking the price of a life-saving drug has been arrested, but it has nothing to do with drug prices. Martin Shkreli is facing charges in connection with a securities probe. His arrest was confirmed today by the FBI. He stirred public outrage earlier this fall when his company jacked up the price of a drug used to treat a life-saving infection by more than 5,000%. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is acknowledging he used a personal email account to conduct some government business during his first months on the job. In an interview with CBS this morning, during a trip to the Middle East, Carter called it a mistake and one that was entirely his own. The same practice by former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has drawn intense criticism and led to an FBI investigation into two emails that are now considered top secret. Carter said he used his iPhone to send administrative messages. Two central Indiana school districts have canceled classes today after officials said threats were made against those schools. School officials in Danville canceled classes following alleged threats from two students who have been arrested. Schools in Plainfield, west of Indianapolis, also canceled classes, citing a threat that was directed to the high school. School districts in Texas and Florida also received threats but decided to stay open today. Well, it's not quite an endorsement, but Russian President Vladimir Putin is praising Donald Trump's talents and his calls for better ties with Russia. Speaking to journalists after his annual news conference today, Putin called Trump an absolute front runner in the presidential race and a bright and talented person. He added that he certainly welcomes Trump's calls for better U.S.-Russia ties. Putin had said earlier he was ready to work with the eventual winner in the presidential race. Stocks were trading lower this morning, a day after the Federal Reserve announced the first increase in interest rates in nearly a decade. Overseas stock markets surged today as the Fed's decision ended a period of uncertainty that had been plaguing markets for months. The Fed's signal that rate increases over the coming months will be gradual also helped ease concerns.
Yeah.
More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:37.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by our members and by the Carolyn Foundation, working to support clean energy systems across the Upper Midwest. More information is available online at carolynfoundation.org.
ClimateCast is supported by Benjamin Franklin Plumbing, specializing in all types of boiler, hydronic, and radiator heating systems, also specializing in drain repair. Live operators are available 24 hours a day. BenFranklinPlumbing.com, the punctual plumbers.
We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
The world did a pretty amazing thing in Paris last Friday. 190 countries came together to say human-caused climate change is a real event and we need to do something about it now. While celebrating that historic accomplishment is certainly warranted, some big questions and big differences on what the COP21 agreement really means still abound. Michael Mann from Penn State said COP21 basically gets us halfway there. Bill McKibben from 350.org said this agreement won't save the planet, not even close, but it's possible that it saves the chance of saving the planet if movements push even harder from here on out. So what's the science behind the Paris Climate Agreement, and who can give us some firsthand insight into how climate scientists are evaluating and feeling about the Paris Agreement from last week? I know a guy and a girl who can help us out with that, and let's start with Sarah Myrie. She's a postdoctoral scholar with the Future of Ice Initiative at the University of Washington, and she joins us today with a whole bunch of other earth scientists at the annual American Geophysical Union Conference in San Francisco. Sarah, welcome to ClimateCast.
Thank you so much. Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Good morning. It's good to talk to you. You know, I was looking at your bio saying one of your areas of expertise, paleoclimate and abrupt climate warming. Talk about what past climate warming events teach us about our current warming and how COP21 is important in this era of warming.
Yeah, absolutely. So past events of climate warming are one of the fundamental ways that we understand how the Earth operates and how the planet responds when we increase greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So we use these past events as laboratories to ask and answer questions about how ecosystems and environments that we care about are going to be vulnerable in the future of rapid climate warming.
John Abraham joins us as well. He's the thermal sciences professor at the University of St. Thomas. John, you're also out at AGU in San Francisco, is that right?
Yes, I am, Paul.
And tell us again, what's a thermal sciences professor do
at
St. Thomas?
Oh, my gosh, that's something you want to explain at a cocktail party. I study heat and fluids in the environment, heat transfer and fluid flow.
Well, let's start with Paris, the science of what happened in Paris. The goal was to limit planetary warming to less than 2 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. If I read these numbers right, John, after all the commitments were met, we're hearing numbers that emissions will still be somewhere around 2.7 degrees Celsius. That's about 4.9 Fahrenheit. Is that your understanding of the science behind COP21?
It's a bit complicated because there's what's called a ratcheting of these emissions targets every 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an initial agreement, and I think that hits the 2.7, but I don't have the agreement in front of me. But then there's a reevaluation every 5 years to improve our emissions performance and then to ratchet them down so that we'll get better results as time goes on. So I don't know if it's with the initial agreements or the ratcheting, but the goal is to get to two.
We're talking with John Abraham of the University of St. Thomas and Dr. Sarah Myrie with the University of Washington about the Paris Climate Agreements. What exactly do they mean? Your questions always welcome. 651-227-6000, toll free 800-242-2828, or jump online at nprnews.org/live. Stephanie Curtis here as well to bring us your questions that way. Sarah, what's your perspective on what happened in Paris? Is it a positive? Obviously, it's a positive step forward. How big, how important is it in light of what actually happened?
Well, it's a really important step that the whole international community has taken. As a climate scientist in our community, we have felt, and I will speak personally about this, but there has been this burden of the knowledge about the risks inherent in rapid climate warming. And those burdens and that risk have been behind closed doors. And now, with this agreement, that information and that science is now in the hands of the people that really need it and need to make decisions about it. So it's a really beautiful thing to see the state of the science being used to make decisions at this very high level. And for me, it gives me hope. And that's really what feeds me on a day-to-day basis, is seeing that the world is responsive and that we, with our shared values, can actually do things that will make a very fundamental difference in what happens to the future of this planet.
And John, we've talked about the trends in emissions with you in the past few years. This year looks like the first year global CO2 emissions actually fell slightly while the world economy is still growing. You think this is a blip in emissions globally, and how does it factor into projections for the success of the targets of COP21?
Well, I'm very hopeful it's not a blip, and you're right. The emissions trajectory has bent over a bit, but people need to know we're still emitting. We're still adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, so that's going up. What we're talking about here, Paul, is the rate at which it rises. And you were right in the term you used, but I don't want people to be confused. CO2 is not going down. It's just rising at a lower rate. I don't think this is a blip for a number of reasons. First of all, we are really rapidly increasing our use of renewable energy. We're using energy more wisely. And some of the dirtiest fossil fuels have been phased out for cleaner, although still they pollute, but they're cleaner alternatives. And as Sarah said, this climate agreement gives us a lot of hope, but there was a lot done before this that set the stage. So we have the USA agreement with China, which we've talked about on your show. We've got the Clean Power Plan from the Obama administration, mm-hmm. Our coal-fired power plants, increased efficiency of vehicles. So there's been a huge workup to this, and
sure,
we're seeing the fruits of that being borne out with this agreement.
Joe is on the line from Minneapolis. Joe, good morning to you. What's your question for John and Sarah this morning?
Good morning. Now, I'm not a climate scientist, but some of the articles that I've read have suggested that just cutting emissions won't be enough, and that we're actually going to have to actively start pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. And I was wondering sort of what your thoughts were on that, what the future was, and how old with regard to that.
John or Sarah, who wants that one?
I'll take that, Paul. That's a really good question, Joe. And we want to make sure that this conversation isn't about, it's not digital in the sense that we're either going to do something or we're not going to do something. Every reduction of emissions that we put in place is going to pay off in the future with a healthier climate. So would it be great if we could get to negative emissions, which is what you're talking about? Yeah, that would be great. But we could get to lower emissions or zero net emissions and still do great things for the environment. So it's really about a risk assessment, and it's about not going to a climate which is so dangerous that it produces a large societal and environmental impact. So, yeah, it'd be great to get to negative emissions, but it isn't necessary to make a big positive impact.
Sarah, you're out there at AGU, the American Geophysical Union. I know there's literally thousands of scientists out there. The folks that you're talking to, how are the scientists there evaluating the science behind this policy agreement?
Well, that's a really important question, because ultimately the scientific community ground truths these kinds of decisions and evaluates whether they are actually going to meet the targets that the international community is agreeing upon. You know, I was sitting with colleagues yesterday and we were talking about just this issue of getting to zero emissions or negative emissions. And ultimately, you know, we don't want to make the perfect the enemy of the good. We want to be able to look at where we're at right now, what we can do, and use all of the levers and all of the options right now to start to reduce emissions. And through this five-year ratcheting agreement and the reevaluative process, we can make progress every 5 years. And so that's a really important framework for us as a scientific community to continue to evaluate and push this agenda forward.
And John, what's the vibe out there? I mean, is this a hot topic of conversation? What are you hearing?
Yeah, pun intended, right, Paul? I got to tell you, over the last few years, when I first started coming to AG and talking to my colleagues maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it was really a gloomy scenario because the problem seemed so intractable and nothing had been done. But over the last 5 or 6 years, slowly things are being done. The U.S. is now a leader in this field. Many other countries are signing on. We have international agreements. We have national agreements. And we're also seeing that countries who take this seriously are not seeing their economies affected adversely. They're actually seeing economic growth in the new energy economy of the future. So over the past few years, we've become more and more hopeful. And I wouldn't say it's a total party out here in San Francisco, but it's about as close as you can get with a bunch of Earth scientists.
Oh, come on. It's always a party in San Francisco, right?
Absolutely. You've got to come out here next year, Paul. I'll tell you, there's a lot of smiling faces.
I'll bet. I would love to get out there. I know it's a very important conference. I want to throw this out to both of you. Feel free, either one of you, to take it. John, you mentioned the trajectory, if you will, of renewable energy. You know, we're seeing a boom in solar. We're seeing costs drop dramatically. We're seeing huge solar farms now going in West Texas, literally on top of oil fields. I know there's one that's something like 900 football fields going in, and there are many, many more being built. What's your assessment of the trajectory of clean energy growth? Is it happening faster than it looked like it might 5 or 10 years ago?
It is, and the reason why is cost. The cost of wind and solar in particular have dropped so much that now they're on par with fossil fuel-generated energy. In the U.S., in Minnesota, Paul, we had this last year a major solar power production that was signed, and it's now being installed. Planning and installation is going to occur in 10 sites in Minnesota. And that project won on cost alone. And so this isn't a case where you're just doing good for the environment by putting in wind and solar and using those energy resources. You're also doing good for your pocketbook. And in the end, that's what's going to tip the scale. When people can get their energy, their electrons, to power their cell phones and to power their car from clean sources, which are cheaper than the alternative.
Sarah, what's your perspective on that?
I agree with John, and I think that there's a story and there's a very strong argument about how renewable energies and the transfer of our energy economy to clean energy will also fundamentally reshape the strength of the middle class in the United States.
That's a bold statement.
Well, I think it's important for us to recognize that the future of our clean energy economy is also the future of our local and state economies. It's the future of my family's access to cheap energy. So these stories are also about our families and our communities.
All right, Josh, in Tyler, Southwest Minnesota, sort of wind and solar central these days. Good morning to you. What's your question for John and Sarah?
Good morning. My question is, is there any talks about, like, bigger tree farms and things, and what size would be needed? Would those help bring down carbon emissions that are in the air? And any talks about, like, possible government programs and things, like the CRP programs, where the government pays you, you know, to plant so many trees, you know, like they do for grasslands and stuff for wildlife?
Sure. John Abraham, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our biodiversity, the plants and trees and animals that live, especially plants and trees, take in carbon dioxide. They breathe it in, and then they store it in their trunks and their tissues. Trees have the ability to store a lot of carbon for a long time, and we call that sequestration. Now, they don't store it forever because over time they will rot once they die, fall to the ground and rot, but they can temporarily reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. But also, just as importantly, if we stop deforestation, that deforestation is a major emission source. So stopping deforestation and planting more trees is one key piece of this puzzle. So would the government have a funding mechanism to encourage this? It would if there were a price on carbon. If you had a price on carbon, then things that you did that reduced carbon would have extra economic value, and it would be a commodity. They could be bought and sold on the market. So, yes, the answer is yes to Josh's question.
Jadrek Hamilton joins us by phone now from St. Paul. She's with Fresh Energy. Jay, you were in Paris. Is that true?
Yes. Thanks, Paul, and thanks to your guests. I just came back from 2 weeks in Paris as part of a delegation, and we met for 1 hour with Secretary of State John Kerry and the U.S. negotiating team.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make sure your listeners know that the U.S. is in a position to meet its part of the Paris Agreement by virtue of laws that have already been passed. So the Clean Power Plan, which for the first time limits carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants. And then in President Obama's first term, he passed, with Congress's help, a doubling of fuel economy standards. So that's really good news. But your guests are absolutely right. We're not doing nearly enough yet to get on the right trajectory. But what this shows is that the U.S. knows how to make those big reductions and make them cost-effectively, and they're going to be saving consumers money as well.
Jay, go ahead, John, jump in there.
What Jay said, it's those kind of plans that were done ahead of Paris that made Paris possible. Because the U.S. and other countries were able to enter from a position of action, and the U.S. entered as a leader, and we were able to say, look, here's what we want to do for the economy, and here's what we want to do for the environment, and look, we've already done it. And so it's not as though Obama's administration has to go back to Congress and get new laws passed. Jay is exactly right. What our first targets are already baked into what we're doing, and setting the stage like that is what made Paris possible.
Jay, I want to ask you real quickly about clean energy jobs in Minnesota. We saw the report from the Minnesota Department of Economic Security and Employment about something like 15,000 jobs and growing in Minnesota. Tell us the ground truth. What's happening in terms of clean energy jobs in Minnesota these days?
Well, yeah, thanks, Paul. It's the reason I went to Paris, because I wanted to draw the links for Minnesotans between what we've already done in the name of growing clean energy jobs and what that's gotten us in terms of carbon reduction. And also I got the chance to talk to delegations from around the world about this, because this is what gives people hope that in Minnesota, which isn't a very big state, we've already grown 15,000 jobs in the clean energy sector, and they pay about 21% higher than the state average wage. So these are really good jobs. They're the kind of jobs that millennials want to have. I was really struck a couple of months ago when one of these solar energy companies said to me, well, I've been spending all day, every day, interviewing millennials for high-tech jobs.
Hmm.
Isn't that a good thing?
It's a good thing, and hopefully that trajectory will continue to accelerate as we move forward and these projects go ahead. Jadrek Hamilton, thanks a lot for jumping in this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Sarah, what's your perspective on where we're going economically with clean energy jobs? I mean, one thing we do here on ClimateCast is we've talked about the sort of problem that climate change is from 1,000 different angles. We like to look at solutions as well. From your perspective, what are you seeing in terms of solutions going forward?
Well, I love the caller that just called in. Jay was just so well informed about the importance of understanding that the clean energy jobs that are going to be available and are available now are the jobs that millennials and the kind of middle-class workers want to have. So these are jobs with skills and expertise that you can have and support a family on. And for me, as a parent, I'm really interested in ensuring that as I educate my son for the job that he's going to have in the future, that those are well-paying jobs that he can support a family on. And so, that's this linchpin of, like, connecting the green economy and renewable jobs with the future of our families and our communities, because the economic struggles that the middle class is facing right now are not going to go away until we reevaluate the connections between our economy and the green economy and the middle class.
And John, we've been in touch a lot about the world global temperature numbers this year in 2015. They're pretty astounding. It looks like we will blow away last year as the warmest year on record globally. Put this year into perspective for us in the climate record.
Oh, man, this has been a really, really hot year. And a report just came out from the Met Office. It looks like 2016 may beat this year. And if that happens, that would be 3 years in a row. But 2015 is, as you say, it's blowing the record off the chart. Last year was the hottest year on record. This year is going to be about 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than last year. Now, 0.2 doesn't sound like a lot, but a few degrees or a fraction of a degree makes a big impact. If you remember the heat wave of 2012, the drought and heat wave of 2012 mm-hmm. cost our country $35 billion in lost agricultural productivity. That year was only about a degree warmer than a typical year. So 0.2 degrees matters a lot. It's about the warming we get in a decade. And so what we see with climate, and we know this, the temperature jumps up and down year to year, but it's the long-term trend you want to look at. And when you break record after record after record, at some point you've got to say, maybe this isn't just a natural cycle. Maybe there's something that more going on here. And it's something scientists have been saying for a long time, but this has been a hot one, Paul.
Sarah, is the potential for 2016 with the El Nino lingering into the first part of the year potentially being another new warmest year on record globally a topic out there at AGU this week?
I mean, that's absolutely a topic. And beyond warming, climate change is not just about the warming of the planet. It's also about the disruption of fundamental Earth systems that we have taken for granted as being very stable. So ocean acidification, the loss of oxygen in the interior of the ocean, the loss of seasonal sea ice, the reorganization of communities that we rely on, fisheries and birds and the timing of the spring bloom, all of these things, these environmental and ecological components are also on the table right now in a future of abrupt warming. So temperature and thinking about temperature is very important. It's that sort of basal measurement that we use. But beyond that, there are many, many other components of this system that are shifting and changing.
Well, Drs. John Abraham and Sarah Myrie, great discussion today. Thanks so much for giving us some perspective on Paris today.
Absolute pleasure, Paul.
Thank you so much.
So about 10 days ago, I had the great pleasure to take my best girl to the always outstanding New Standards show at the State Theater. And I know if you've seen Jan, Chan, and Steve and the band, you know this is a special holiday treat. So out strolls Dan Wilson of Semisonic Closing Time fame, and he plays a new song he wrote. It was kind of an interesting, crazy mashup for a weather geek like me. It was about love, weather, climate change, and Christmas. And I'm thinking, we got to play that on ClimateCast. So we leave you today with a cut from The Hottest Christmas Ever from Dan Wilson. Happy holidays, everybody.